shipments, but he didn't have enough time to pull the trigger. The consultant was gone. Urzaiah growled, tightening his grip on his hatchets. "They will not fight me! They only hide!" It was true. After the initial attack on Ulsa, the consultants had fallen back to guerrilla tactics. Urzaiah and Calder were standing out in the open, but they were far enough away from any hiding places that they remained unharmed. Watchmen were clustered together, holding guns, swords, or spikes, keeping their backs to one another in case of ambush. Another woman in a black coat strayed too close to the back of their shelter, and she pitched over with 3 inches of steel sticking out of her back. "They're stalling," Calder realized. He spun back to the crater, where Tristania was still covering Nabarius. A single body in black lay near the Silent One, its chest burned and smoking, but other than that, they seemed absolutely unharmed. "Follow me," Calder ordered, and then he began to march in a loop around the edge of the crater. Urzaiah followed him, looming like the world's most intimidating shadow. If Shara wanted Nabarius, she would have to strike at him from above, or else run down into the cauldron herself. Either way, Calder would be able to catch sight of her up here. He saw a black-clad ankle sticking out from behind a seaweed frond and fired. The consultant, a man, staggered out of cover, allowing Urzaiah to finish him off. The Blackwatch shelter, little more than a hastily constructed driftwood shed, held 3 more consultants that struck as soon as Calder and his cook strayed within range. First, a tiny blade spun out from behind the shelter. Calder swatted it out of the air with the edge of his cutlass, a little disappointed. He had been trained better than to fall for that. A black-clad woman leaped from the top of the shelter, a knife in each hand. Not Shara. She was taller, thinner, and her knives were well-worn steel instead of bronze. Urzaiah grabbed her by the collar with one hand, slamming her into the ground. Her bones snapped, and she fell limp. The other two struck at the same time, hurling a knife and moving to flank Calder. If he'd been alone, it might have worked. Urzaiah snatched the knife out of the air, laughed, and threw it back. The consultant dodged, but it threw the man off balance, and Calder slashed a line across the man's arm. With one arm and nothing more than a dagger, he managed to turn 3 of Calder's follow-up strikes in as many seconds. Calder couldn't help but be impressed as he ran the other man through. The consultant's death echoed through the blade, focusing the weapon's intent. The more Calder accomplished with this sword, the stronger it would become. Like all tools, it was invested with each use. He turned back to Urzaiah, only to find the man lowering his arms. A long scream, followed by the sound of impact, suggested that his opponent had just landed somewhere far away. The woodsman laughed, and Calder couldn't help but ask a question that had bothered him for some time. "Do you enjoy this?" Urzaiah shrugged, continuing his march around the crater and forcing Calder to catch up.
"The arena was not so bad. I thought I would die many times, but that has a special kind of fun to it. You understand?"
He did. Combat terrified Calder, and he would avoid it for the rest of his life if he could, but there was something about a fight that set the blood on fire. His wife had felt that thrill more than he did. Jerry will be sorry she missed this. The thought was followed by a shock of pain and anger that sobered Calder up. He wasn't fighting for the thrill of it. He had work to do. They circled the whole crater without running into anyone else. The atmosphere had settled into a tense, quiet standoff. Ulsa kneeling at the bottom, musket pressed against her shoulder, Nabarius sawing away at the tendons with Tristania standing over him. Watchmen huddling in clusters, watching each other, eyes pointed outward. The consultants were invisible, but a noise here and there suggested that they hadn't yet left. Where was Shara? She had to be here if she was after Nabarius. Why hadn't she? The chronicler's saw snapped through the tendon, and he clutched the heart to his chest like an anthem addict with his stash. And everything became clear. They weren't after Nabarius at all. Not anymore.
"Nabarius!" Calder shouted. "They're after the heart!"
The stillness shattered like dropped glass. Shara emerged in the center of the crater as though she had simply appeared there. For a moment, he refused to believe the sight. There was no way she could possibly have gotten down there without him seeing. And yet there she was, black hair falling around her face like a hood, mouth covered by black cloth, holding a bronze knife in her right hand as she ran straight at Tristania's back. But that wasn't all. At the instant Shara appeared, a mournful howl rose through the air, like a mother grieving the death of her child. Hideous creatures boiled up all around, rising from suddenly opening gashes in the ground like drops of blood from a wound. Spiders made entirely of bone, but the size of men, their heads like oversized skulls. Hairless dogs with blue-gray flesh and long bladed tails. Four armed giants standing head and shoulders over Urzaya, their skin pale and blue like drowning victims. Elder spawn born from ancient graves. The children of the dead mother. One more time, Andal cursed himself for straying so far from the crater. He had stayed with Petal and Foster when they visited the main base of the Black Watch, a cluster of tents, lean-tos, and temporary wooden shelters far down the beach from the Testament. He'd let Calder go visit his mother, reasoning that the captain would be safe among so many Blackwatch, and only the Emperor himself could have stopped Urzaya from wandering off. It had proven naive, but he'd expected them to come back quickly. He had never thought the attack would come on the very first day they arrived, not to mention the second attack. He stood back to back with a consultant who had tried to kill him only minutes before, using his saber to parry the attacks of something that looked like a living vulture skeleton. Its bones were held together by nothing more than rotting strips of muscle and skin, and it struck with the needle-sharp tips of its bony wings. Andal knocked one wing aside and hammered at the bird's skull with the edge of his sword until he heard a crack. Something glistened inside. Did this thing still have a brain? He wasn't sure, but he pulled his pistol and blew its skull off anyway. The skeleton fell, lifeless, so he spun to help the black-clad man behind him. The consultant had surrendered after Andal stabbed him in the leg, so Andal had embraced one of the unknown god's tenets, mercy for the undeserving, and accepted the surrender. He had just finished bandaging the man's leg when these hideous dead creatures of Nakothi had come crawling up from the ground inside their tent. Well, he would let Kelerak take him before he let a patient die right in front of him. The consultant slammed the blunt end of one knife down on the head of his enemy, which looked hideously like a deformed child. Its bruised purple skin writhed over its skeletally thin body, and it hissed through a mouth of jagged teeth. It opened its jaws to take a bite out of the man's wounded leg. Andal skewered it through the chest, pinning it to the ground like an insect to a board. He left it there, squirming, and picked up another saber from the corpse of a watchman. Panting, the consultant dropped into a chair. He gestured to the child creature. "Are you going to leave it there?" The man had a neutral, capital accent. He could have come from anywhere. "I find that I no longer have a use for that sword," Andal said. He was no reader, but he still didn't want a blade that remembered being inside an elder spawn. Who knew what horrible intent the weapon would carry with it? Foster fired his musket, shouted in triumph at a successful shot, and handed the gun to Petal. She poured the powder with shaking hands, spilling as much on the ground as she got in the weapon. The gunner pulled a pistol, fired, and a splatter of liquid hit the outside of the tent. He fired another and a third, pulling new pistols out as needed. Petal scurried from one to the next, reloading as quickly as she could. A shadow darkened the front of the tent. With his left hand, Andal grasped the white sun pendant. With his right, he steadied the watchman's stolen saber. A bone-white claw, like a giant crab's, slashed the front of the tent open. The child of Nakothi peered in, and its face? Andal shuddered and had to force himself not to look away. Its whole head was a writhing mass of flesh stalks, each capped by a disgustingly human-looking eye. He focused on his sword. The hilt shook ever so slightly against the blade, and the weapon was a little heavy on the back end, something manufactured for battle, not crafted by an expert. It would have to do. Andal would fight this disgusting crab thing with a broken bottle if he had to. The consultant stepped up beside him, a knife in one hand and a clutch of needles in the other. From the man's expression, Andal knew that they were both prepared to die. Then a woman shouted, and the bone claw fell to the ground, leaking cloudy white blood. The child of Nakothi screamed like a man being tortured, falling back and flailing with its second, smaller claw. Andal could only get a glimpse of its opponent through the slash in the tent. The figure moved in a streak of black clothes, gleaming bronze, and blonde hair. The two of them moved past, and Andal had to watch the rest of the fight in the shadows they cast against the tent. The woman's silhouette passed through the dark mass that must have been the bone crab. Another hideous scream, and then the creature gurgled into silence. A small river of milky blood trickled under the tent. The wounded consultant shivered, wiping his forehead with the back of his hand.
"Gardeners, at last," he said, his voice shaky.
"Thank—" A blonde-haired blur ran into the tent, and before Andal knew what was happening, a clawed hand rushed at his eyes. He brought his sword up on pure instinct, but the blade was slapped aside, and he found his throat in a crushing grip. He fell back against something hard, maybe a table, that gouged into his spine. It was a welcome distraction from his throat, which felt as though she had tightened a noose around his whole neck.
"Ally!"
the wounded consultant yelled, moving forward.
"He's an ally!"
The pressure released from Andal's throat. Andal collapsed to his knees, coughing and desperately trying to seize a breath. He forced himself up, raising his saber. He had to fight, to do something. His attacker was moving toward Foster and Petal. In the second it took to get his eyes on the scene, she was already finished. She held Foster's musket in her left hand and Petal's hair in her right, and she was dragging the girl away from a case of glass bottles that the alchemist strained and struggled to reach. This was Andal's first clear look at his attacker. She was younger than he would have thought. Not yet 25, he would guess. Her hair was bright blonde, cut short enough that it wouldn't fall into her eyes as she fought. She'd pulled black cloth over her mouth, and a pair of hilts stuck out from behind her lower back. Her whole body was sheathed in black except her hands, which, Andal squinted, looking closer. Her left hand seemed to be clawed and blue-tinged, stretched slightly bigger than normal. Her pupils had the vertical slits of a lizard. An Imperial Guard, perhaps? All of that went through his mind as he placed his sword on the table behind him, raising his empty hands.
"You think we should be fighting each other?"
he asked.
"You didn't do much fighting."
She hefted Petal by the hair, and the alchemist whimpered. The male consultant limped up to her, hands spread.
"Gardener, these are not our enemies. They accepted my surrender and fought with me against the children."
The gardener surveyed the room, her gaze lingering on the shattered skeleton bird and the imp impaled on Andal's saber.
"Looks like you didn't do much fighting either, Shepherd."
Without a word, she released Petal's hair and tossed Foster's musket back. He caught it with a squawk and began muttering to himself, fussing over the gun as though she tossed his infant. The gardener flexed her hand, and the short claws withdrew, the blue tint fading back to the normal hue of healthy skin, her pupils returning to a human shape. She started to walk out of the tent.
"Follow me if you want to fight Elderspawn," she said. "I won't kill you unless you make me."
Foster moved his musket as though he meant to turn it on her, and she appeared in front of him faster than Andal could track, gripping the end of his gun.
"That means you too, sir," she said.
"Sir," Andal thought. A bellow like an enraged bull's cut through the sounds of battle. His gaze met Foster's.
"Messiah,"
Petal whispered. The gardener's blonde head snapped around at the sound of the name.
"You're soulbound."
The consultants knew about their crew. Andal supposed it wasn't so surprising. Supposedly, the consultants knew everything. But it still disturbed him to think that killers like these knew every detail of their combat capabilities. He decided to use a little truth to his advantage. He smiled, just a little, and tipped his hat to her.
"Our champion."
Her eyes widened, and he was treated to a clear view as the pupils snapped from round to a vertical line. Then she was gone, the tent flap swinging in the wake of her exit.
"What are you doing telling her that?" Foster grumbled. "And you, girl, saying her Zaya's name."
Petal muttered to herself, hiding in a veil of frizzy hair.
"They know us anyway,"
Andal said.
"Might as well scare them a little."
He hefted his sword again.
"Now, let's see if we can save the captain."
When Shara stabbed the back of Tristania's coat, she hit with more force than any of the musket shots had. She led with the blade of her bronze knife, striking the fabric with her weapon's tip. The bullets had done nothing, but this blade must have been invested with more intent than Calder could imagine. It tore through the cloth, instantly drawing blood. The force drove the Silent One forward, knocking her over Nabarius, sending her sprawling to the ground. The Chronicler staggered to his feet, clutching the heart of Nekothi, but Calder could only hope the man stayed alive long enough to be saved. He was too busy running back to the edge of the crater, looking for the knotted rope. The Elder Spawn didn't let him get far. Something like a severed spine on a centipede's legs slithered up to him, and he ducked as he ran, slashing it in half with his cutlass. "Death to the deathless," he chanted silently, letting his intent flow down into the blade. It wouldn't help too much against the children of the dead mother, not unless he continued investing it for weeks, but any tiny advantage would help when he was forced to fight the living dead blade to bone. The spine centipede shriveled and died when he slashed it in half, so maybe it worked. A headless, hairless, heavily muscled gorilla lurched up to him, loping forward on pale-skinned knuckles. Calder raised his shaking cutlass. "Urzaiah!" he shouted. The gorilla got closer. "Now, Urzaiah!" He got a glimpse of tanned skin as Urzaiah launched himself into the crater, a black hatchet in each hand and blonde hair streaming behind him. He landed in a spray of blood from the ground, only feet from Shara. Urzaiah had never taken his eyes from his prey. Admirable in other circumstances, but this left Calder to fight a charging dead gorilla alone with nothing more than a flimsy piece of metal. "Light and life preserve me." The expression had never been more appropriate. The headless gorilla reached him, eerily silent. It raised a fist to slam his head down into his shoulders. Calder tried for a smooth, agile dodge, but he ended up sort of falling sideways. The fist struck him in the side like a sack full of hammerheads, sending a shock of bone-crunching pain up his left arm and sending him staggering a few steps to his right. He still managed to keep his cutlass up, slashing the creature across the chest. Milky white fluid crept down its flesh in a line. He might as well have given it a kiss. It didn't so much as flinch, turning and charging him again without delay. As he ducked under a clumsy punch aiming for his head, slipping past the gorilla's blue-white body, he reflected on how frustrating it was to fight a headless opponent. He had never realized the value of an enemy's reactions, grunting in pain to let him know that he'd scored a point, panting when they were tired, screaming when they were scared, generally exchanging banter in the middle of a fight. Engaging a mute enemy was just unsatisfying. Not to mention terrifying, since one square blow would reduce his bones to powder. He danced another round with the monstrous gorilla, trying to ignore the screams around him as the Black Watch fought their own creatures and the sounds of battle from within the pit. He left a scratch on the monster's back just as a deafening roar sounded from inside the crater. "Urzaiah has some impressive lungs," he thought. "Maybe I should promote him. Andal couldn't yell that loud if he tried." He yearned to go down there, but only his own quick movements and the gorilla's graceless attacks had kept him alive this long. If he turned his back, the monster would pull his arms from their sockets. A streak of black passed by, and he caught a glimpse of blonde hair. Then a gout of white blood sprayed from the gorilla creature right where its head should have been, splattering on his clothes. He staggered back, more from the stench than the surprise. The blood smelled like spoiled sausages and putrid cheese, like carrion and burned hair. The faint smell followed each of the children like a miasma, but now it was coming from his clothes. He dry heaved and tore his jacket off at the same time, more frightened of the smell than of the gorilla's flailing fists. Only when he could breathe again did he take a look at the monster, which lay dying on the flesh of the ground. A consultant stood with her back to him. Blonde hair cut short. She held a bronze knife in one hand, and her other flexed open and closed in a vaguely disquieting manner. "Thanks," he panted, as soon as he caught his breath. She half turned to look at him.
"You're quite welcome."
Then she vaulted into the crater just as Urzaiah had done, ignoring the ropes.
"That's just not fair. Why could everyone do that but him?"
He scrambled closer to the rope before another dead monster could interrupt him. Urzaiah needed his help, and unless he was mistaken, there were now two consultant assassins down there, not to mention his mother. Chapter 12. Present Day. Calder fell from the rope into the bottom of the flesh crater and instantly had to fight for his life. A blue-skinned imp the size of a child hissed at him when he landed, scrambling toward him on all fours and opening its mouth wide. He jerked back, knocked off guard by its sudden assault. The imp snarled at him, flailing in a storm of claws and teeth, clambering to reach him. He held the creature at bay with his sword, trying to shove his blade down the thing's throat, but it caught the steel of his cutlass in its teeth. He had to use both hands to lift the whole ensemble, sword and elderspawn together, and slam it against the wall until the point of his blade stuck out the back of the monster's head. Only then, panting, could he turn back to the real fight. Tristania huddled against the nearby wall of the crater, bleeding, occasionally flicking her explosive whip at the children of Nakothi that surrounded her. Each time she did, a white light detonated at the point of impact, and they were blown back in a spray of bone fragments and pale blood. The wrappings near the back of her ribs were soaked with red, but he supposed that was the advantage of wearing bandages everywhere. She had simply tied a few strips of cloth a little tighter to bind the wounds. Nabarius lay nearby on his stomach, holding the heart of Nakothi in one hand and trying to crawl away. After only an instant, Calder saw the inch of steel sticking out of his left calf. It looked as though he'd tried to run, only to have one of the consultants stop him with a thrown blade. His dark blue suit was filthy with stains, and his hair, for once, was no longer perfect. Also, Greyweather had a long cut on the side of her cheek, but she fought against the children with her back to the wall. She must have been out of ammunition, because she fought with her musket in both hands like a club. In the first instant, he saw her knock a shambling corpse to one side with the butt of the gun, drive an iron spike through the head of a hairless dog, and then turn back to the corpse only to kick its knees out from under it. He moved toward his mother for the same reason that the children of Nakothi were focused on her, because the other fighters were far too terrifying. Urzaya laughed as he fought, black hatchet in each hand. The gold hide wrapped around his arm gleamed in the sun, and his leather breastplate hung from one severed strap. He slammed one hatchet down, and the blonde consultant caught the blow on her two crossed bronze knives. Her arms looked blue, almost the same hue as these dead creatures, and muscles shifted strangely beneath the skin, but she managed to hold off Urzaya's impossible strength. Behind him, Shara flicked a blade at Urzaya's back, then turned to drive her bronze knife through one of the children. Without looking, the Azirian gladiator reached back and swatted the blade out of the air with his second hatchet. The blonde saw another of those headless gorillas loping for her, and she leaped onto its shoulders, using it as a footstool to flip over Urzaya and drive her pair of bronze knives down toward his neck. Urzaya dropped his hatchets, grabbing her by the wrists and moving as if to slam her down to the ground, but she twisted somehow until she was sitting on his shoulders, legs wrapped around his neck in a stranglehold. Shara moved to drive a knife into his back, but he spun and caught her arm, hurling her into the wall. Then he fell over backwards like a toppling tree, crushing the blonde consultant beneath him. The children of the dead mother, sensing vulnerability, swarmed around them. Calder had to trust Urzaya to handle that fight, because there wasn't much he could do to help. He hurried over to his mother, trying not to think about his growing shame and irritation. He rarely felt weak. Though he knew Urzaya was a soulbound and an experienced fighter, the difference between them had never seemed so stark. Calder was soulbound himself, after all, and when he stood on the testament, none of his crew could match his power. But seeing Urzaya here, off the ship, made him feel ordinary and useless. As he ran past Nabarius, still scrambling to crawl away, he had a sudden thought that made him stop in his tracks. Do not let yourself be distracted by violence. Battle is a game men play to reach an objective, but the battle itself does not matter. Only the objective matters. Not Sedesthenes, one of the classical strategists. Lorelei, maybe. He dropped to his knees in front of Nabarius and grabbed the heart of Nakothi. The witness resisted. Perhaps he didn't trust Calder, or perhaps he had been fighting to hold on to the heart for so long that he couldn't comprehend releasing it to anyone. The organs squirted gray-green blood over their hands, but neither man let go. Nabarius! Calder yelled, trying to shock the man back to his senses. Let go! I'm trying to help! I can draw the consultants away! The chronicler snarled until his face twisted. If he hadn't known better, Calder might not have recognized the man. It's mine! What was this? Was this the real Nabarius, or had attempting to read the Elder artifact done something to his mind? Calder had grown up on stories of readers being driven insane by accidentally contacting the Elder powers, and he'd seen the results of such insanity firsthand. If this was Elder madness, then Calder had little chance of ever seeing his payment. The thought put him in a bad enough mood that he acted on his first instinct. He punched Nabarius in the nose. Not too hard, but enough to startle the man into releasing the heart. Calder ran away, ignoring Nabarius and his rage, running back to the rope. If he could make it to the testament, then maybe he could hold off the consultants himself. He had no doubt that the Lyathaton would be more than a match for the children of the dead mother. He wasn't making an intentional effort to read anything, but some hunch made him turn and raise his cutlass. It saved his life. Shara's bronze blade scraped along the edge of his cutlass, raising sparks. A sort of manic cheer rose up in Calder, and he lifted the heart. How about a trade? She pulled a 2-inch hiltless knife from a pouch on her thigh, throwing it at him sidearm. At this distance, he couldn't try to knock it away with his sword, but he jerked to one side, catching it on the thick fabric of his coat. It still hit him with more force than he'd expected, but he managed to avoid having an artery opened, so he wasn't complaining. Then Shara was on him, and he fought for his life. He regretted not taking the time to reload his pistol. Her eyes were dead over her black half-mask, blade striking like bronze lightning. Only fear and desperation made him fast enough to meet her strikes, and he kept backstepping, trying to get far enough that his extra reach with the sword would matter. But if he put too much distance between them, then she would have free rein with her throwing blades. He lived long enough to back up a few steps, and then he asked the important question. Where's my wife? She swept a kick at his ankles, and which he avoided. He managed to prick her just above the hip with the point of his sword as he dodged her strike, which filled him with confidence. Bold now, he stepped up and kicked her in the ribs. Where is my wife? The consultant took the kick with a grunt, then took advantage of his proximity to drive a knife into his leg. He jerked back quickly enough to avoid a crippling strike, but she still sliced across his shin. The pain flashed through his whole leg as though a shark had taken a bite from his limb, and he screamed. Form forgotten, he slashed blindly with his cutlass, trying to score a cut wherever he could. She stood just outside the reach of his blade, crouching, her left hand behind her back as though she was hiding something from him. He gritted his teeth against the pain, holding his sword up to defend. If she threw something, he would have just enough time to dodge it and catch her as she tried to move closer. This was his chance, and he couldn't let pain slow him down. He would take this consultant back to the ship, even if it meant taking her back in pieces. As children of Nakothi howled and screeched around them, she stayed in the same pose. Was she waiting for something? He couldn't afford to move first. If he misstepped on his injured leg, she'd see him dead. With one smooth motion, she pulled her hand back out, and Calder realized he hadn't seen her second bronze blade. Now she held one in each hand, but his situation hadn't changed. He still needed to wait. There was something wrong with the second knife. The pain in his leg didn't matter. It was a shallow wound, only skin deep, though it hurt like fire. Even Jerry didn't matter for the moment, and the lethal threat of this assassin fled from his mind. He couldn't seem to take his eyes from that battered bronze blade. What is that? He asked, horrified. The weapon pressed on his senses from here, and he'd only seen a handful of items in his life with that much raw intent. An imperial artifact? Surely not. An ordinary object touched by the Emperor escaped the Imperial Guard here and there, but they would never have missed a weapon. But he knew he couldn't let that blade touch him. Shara rushed him, leading with the ordinary knife in her right hand. He slapped it aside with the flat of his sword, eyes still on her left hand. Calder focused his intent on his cutlass, chanting in his mind to focus his power. Protect me. You can hold. You're steel, solid steel, and you are an impenetrable barrier that will shield me from harm. She swept in, driving her left-hand blade in an arc that would take him across the stomach. He shoved his sword in the way, focusing all his intent on knocking her weapon aside. The bronze knife met his steel, hit with an impact that shook him like a sail in high wind, and then sheared right through. The top half of his blade tumbled off, glowing orange at the severed end. He hadn't thought to dodge. He was only lucky that his cutlass had knocked her blow enough out of the way that he wasn't eviscerated. As it was, he lost only a corner of his coat. Instead of backing off, the assassin stepped closer until she pressed against him. Face to face, Shara looked him in the eyes and spoke.
"She's dead," she said.
His breath left him. Then she struck him in the wrist. Shattering pain lanced through his arm, and his hand spasmed open. The heart of Nakothi fell out. She snatched it from the air and spun away, heading back to her comrade. Calder wanted to follow, but he couldn't. He just couldn't. He let the pain of his wounds swallow him, let it burn until he sank to his knees. Hideous creatures born of bone and flesh loped closer, now that the consultant was gone, hissing at the scent of his blood. He wasn't sure he cared. Then his vision was swallowed up by smoke and panic returned. There was something about losing his sight that struck something primal inside him, making him react through the listless haze of depression. A pale-skinned hand reached out of the black cloud surrounding him, and he slashed it, running blindly in the other direction. A bone claw swept out, reaching for his legs, and he managed to stagger away. The cloud of smoke cleared surprisingly quickly, and the consultants were missing. Just gone, as though they'd never been there.
"No!"
Urzaya roared, slamming his hatchet into a bone crab so hard that the giant creature tumbled head over shell for yards until it cracked into the wall.
"Not again! Not again!"
Another tear opened up in the flesh at Urzaya's feet, and another spine-like centipede crawled out. He crushed it under the heel of one boot without looking down. Calder hadn't noticed during the fight, but now he finally realized. The children of the dead mother had never stopped appearing. More and more crawled out of the sewer-sized tunnels in the crater, swarming closer to the humans. A contingent of Blackwatch slid down the crater walls, many of them clutching black spikes in either hand. When an elder spawn made contact with the awakened iron, they fell to the ground in piles of limp bone and flesh. His mother had told him once that it took 7 spikes to immobilize an elder, but a single blow was enough for these spawn. Though the watchmen hadn't been much use against the consultants, this was the fight they'd been trained for. Men and women in black coats against the creations of the great elders. No weapons forbidden, no quarter given. Calder moved to his mother. She had taken command back as soon as the smoke cleared.
"Retreat!" she called. "Back to the shelter!"
He was about to follow her orders when a hand seized his injured leg and he shouted again, lifting his other foot to kick at whatever creature had grabbed him. It was Nabarius. Instead of panicked, he looked desperate, as though someone had taken his child from his arms.
"Where is it?" he pleaded. "Do you have it?"
Calder tried to think of some excuse, but he was far too tired. "She has it, Nabarius. She's gone." The chronicler's wail sounded like a man on the verge of tears. Ulsa grabbed her son by the shoulder, moving him toward the rope.
"I'll have 2 men take him out."
He looked around and saw that 2 black-coated watchmen were already carrying Tristania between them, her blood-stained coat dragging along the ground.
"I talked to her, mother," Calder said listlessly. "She said Jerry's dead."
Ulsa Greyweather shook him, her saber gripped tight in her other hand.
"This is not the time, Calder. We have to move."
She was right, and he knew it. So he moved. It turns out the Blackwatch did have a shelter worth the name. Almost a fort, it had been constructed in obvious haste by lashing hundreds of logs together for walls, fences, and supports. With his leg and other lesser wounds bandaged, Calder sat in a creaking chair next to a table piled high with weapons. Watchmen bustled here and there, and his crew gathered around him. They were all relatively unharmed, he was glad to see. Andal had a new sword that didn't quite fit in his sheath, and his white suit bore new stains. Petal shivered more than usual, clutching a case of potions to her chest.
Foster grumbled as he peered through his reading glasses, inspecting the barrel of a musket. Urzaya sat with his back to a wall, eyes closed, breathing deep and even. His hatchets were bare on his lap, and Calder hadn't gathered the courage to speak to him yet. No one had. The watchman avoided him. Outside the shelter, 1,000 inhuman voices raised in a chorus of howls. The walls shuddered constantly under the force of many blows, as though they suffered through an earthquake. They didn't have long. Calder didn't know much about the children of Nakothi specifically, but he knew that the Testament couldn't hold everyone on the island, and the ship was their only chance of escaping with their lives. Alsa pushed hair out of her eyes, addressing the whole assembly.
We have more allies, and they should be coming soon. But if they're not here in a matter of minutes, nothing of us will remain to reinforce. I have never seen such a gathering of Elderspawn.
That which sleeps, one watchman muttered, before the woman beside him elbowed him in the ribs.
Alsa glanced at him, but didn't make a comment.
Most of the children seem to be gathered here. If we muster everything we can and punch through their line, we should be able to make it down the beach to the Testament. Calder, can the Lyathaton help us?
The elder that pulled his ship was notoriously unwilling to fight unless something specifically disturbed its rest. He had already begged it to fight the Stormwing scarcely a month past, and to a creature that existed on the scale of eons, a month may as well have been 5 minutes ago.
I'll make sure of it, he said, projecting confidence.
He wasn't actually certain, but if need be, he would appeal to the Lyathaton's master. He shuddered to think what such a meeting would cost him, but surely not as much as his life. Anything short of that was a bargain at this point.
She nodded sharply. Then that settles it. We need to gather—
Nabarius strode into the room, his silent one limping along at his side. His suit was still stained and ruined, but he must have found time to comb his hair, because his dark locks tumbled down to his shoulders. Once more, he had the look of a battered hero who had survived a terrible battle. Calder remembered the chronicler's face as he'd begged for the heart. He clutched the grip of his pistol. But Nabarius seemed in control of himself this time, waiting to be seated until Tristania pulled out a chair for him. She slid it under the table after he sat, like a servant back in the Greyweather house. Once he was seated properly, she lifted the case of polished wood from back on the ship, placing it gently on the table. Nabarius flipped the latches and pulled open the lid. Inside, in settings of velvet, sat 8 white candles. 7 of them were whole and pristine, the 8th burned halfway down. At last he spoke, his voice as cool and composed as ever.
What are our chances of making it out of this enclosure and all the way to the ship, do you think?
From Alsa's expression, Calder thought she would rather punch the witness than answer him, but her words were polite.
Some of us will certainly make it. Some certainly will not.
He nodded, his hand hovering over the various candles like a produce merchant selecting the ripest fruit.
With those odds in mind, I believe I may have a solution.
Some of the watchmen around him froze. Calder hadn't realized they were paying such close attention, but it seemed the entire room held its breath in anticipation of his solution. Outside, the children howled like a foul wind.
Explain, if you will, witness,
Alsa said in a tight voice.
As you know, I served for many years in the Imperial Palace. My primary duties involved finances, but living around the Emperor, you find yourself exposed to certain truths. Especially as a reader. There were techniques he designed that worked against the spawn of great elders and failed against others.
Nabarius finally seized on one of the whole candles, though it seemed outwardly the same as all the others. He would have memories stored in that wax. Weeks or months of experience, waiting to be released until the candle was lit. But he closed his eyes as he gripped the candle, tilting his head with the air of a man savoring a sensation. Calder thought he understood. Though he could not relive his memories perfectly without burning the candles, the man was still a reader, and the memory storage was essentially a function of human intent. He would be able to read certain details with a touch. The chronicler spoke as if from the depths of a dream.
In my contact with the heart of Nakothi, I saw some missing pieces. At last, I understood the nature of the children, I should be able to speak their language, if you will.
Of all the people gathered, Foster was the one to speak up, though he kept his eyes on the gun in his hands.
If there's a point in there, Chronicler, you'd best get to it. I don't fancy meeting the Emperor so soon.
Nabarius shot a glance to Calder, and anger flashed across his countenance.
This would be so much easier if I had the heart, but I will work with what I have. The children understand only death and rebirth. They want, they need, they crave to introduce the living to the sort of deadly remaking that they've already experienced. And they will only go away,
he placed the candle back in its housing and shut the case,
if they believe they have succeeded. I can deceive them.
The room was silent for a moment before Ulsa spat out,
What does that mean, Nabarius?
He offered her a dazzling smile that seemed completely out of sync with the scene around him.
That I will handle it. Tristania!
The silent one took his case of candles, and Nabarius rose from his seat. Without another word, the two of them walked toward the wall. Tristania's hair stuck out from her bandages, and her shredded and bloodied coat drifted along behind. Both of them walked with a limp, reaching out and steadying the other as they walked. Calder hadn't seen it before, but Nabarius' wound had been treated, his calf wrapped with a white bandage. As they limped away, blood soaked through the cloth. Andal adjusted his hat and deliberately turned away from the two witnesses.
They're dead, he said. What's the real plan?
Ulsa nodded and looked up at the surrounding watchmen.
Everyone, gather as many weapons as you can. Mobile wounded support one another. Keep the injured to the center, with the crew of the Testament. If you're in fighting condition, you're on the outside. We're going out the gate in 5 minutes, so be with us or stay and face Nakothi in person.
A few of the Black Watch raised their iron nails in a sort of salute and hurried off to carry out her orders. For his part, Calder kept watching the witnesses. He had no reason to trust Nabarius, but the man did seem confident about his solution, and no one knew better than Calder the sorts of desperate plans you could come up with after reading a bit of obscure information. The Chronicler was speaking with his Silent One as they walked. Tristania turned as though surprised, and for the first time, Calder saw her speak. At least, the bandages around her lips moved. They were too far away for him to hear, and he found himself unconsciously following them, using an unloaded musket as a crutch. He couldn't deny a certain curiosity. If Nabarius really knew some piece of reading that could keep an army of Elderspawn from their gates, then that was something Calder wanted to learn. And he found himself wondering what Tristania would sound like. There was something enticing about hearing the voice of someone who never spoke. On this side of the log wall, someone had set up a set of rickety stairs, scarcely better than a ladder, leading up to a platform. The Black Watch would have used this short tower to see over the wall, keeping a lookout when the island seemed too quiet. Tristania and Nabarius helped each other up the steps now, limping pathetically until they reached the top. Calder stood at the bottom, eyeing the stairs. There is no way I'm doing that, he thought. Walking out here on a slashed leg was one thing, but he wasn't about to attempt stairs. Nabarius leaned over the side, and Tristania joined him, looking down at the children of Nakothi below. The wall shook with the impact of dead fists, claws and fingers, and other stranger appendages reaching through the gaps in the logs. Calder took one prudent step back. The Chronicler said something, and Tristania laughed. This time, Calder heard it. Her voice was high, clear, surprisingly young, and weary, as though she laughed because she was too tired to do anything else. While the Silent One still leaned over the wall, Nabarius pulled out one of his Dalton Foster original pistols. He pressed the barrel to the back of Tristania's head. She turned slowly, not alarmed, and Calder shouted a startled warning. His hand scrambled to his own pistol, but he got tangled in the musket he was using for a crutch. He had some vague thought of shooting Nabarius before he could pull the trigger. He was too late. The shot was swallowed up in the din the children caused, no louder than their screams. Tristania's body shuddered and slumped against the wall. Nabarius stood there for a moment, the palms of his hands pressing against her shoulders. Calder couldn't exactly see what he was doing, but he could feel the flow of great intent even at this distance. Then Nabarius reached down, grabbing his Silent One by the legs, and flipped her body over the wall. The children of the dead mother went silent. Finally, Calder leveled his pistol, pointing straight at the back of Nabarius' blue suit.
"Throw your weapons down,"
he demanded, his voice harsh in his own ears. Back in the main shelter, the Black Watch had raised a cheer. They would have heard the monsters growing silent. With his back still turned, Nabarius raised both hands.
"I'm no threat to you, Captain. I just saved your life."
Calder couldn't find the words to name the questions that ran through his head, the pain he felt for a silent woman he barely knew. All he said was,
"Why?"
Nabarius slowly turned, his face a mask.
"We still have a job to do." "Why her?"
The chronicler frowned.
"Would you have trusted me enough to follow me up here and turn your back?"
Calder's heart flared up with rage, and he thumbed back the hammer of his weapon.
"Why don't you turn back around, Nabarius? Look over the side. Trust me."
A dark hand rested on Calder's arm, and he turned to see Andal standing there in his white suit.
"Not the time, Captain."
As always, Andal spoke reason, but that didn't fit. Andal Patronus was the eternal voice of mercy, the defender of innocence. Calder usually had to talk him out of avenging the helpless.
"Even you, Andal?"
The quartermaster's grip tightened on his arm, and Calder finally lowered his pistol.
"You should listen, because it's coming from me, sir,"
Andal said forcefully.
"We need to get out of here."
Calder took a deep breath and shoved his emotions down deep. Everything he still felt, his fear, his relief at being alive, his sickness at failing to capture Shara again, his grief, he stuffed it down, forcing his mind back to the job. The children were quiet for now, but that didn't mean he wanted to spend a second longer on the island than he had to.
10,000 gold marks, he said to Nabarius, his voice cold.
That elder-spawned worm smiled.
"Lead the way, Captain."
By the time they reached the testament, there wasn't a single elder-spawn in sight. Calder could sense the Lyathaton drifting beneath the island, dreaming incomprehensible dreams. He had already issued orders to have the hold emptied to fit all the watchmen aboard. They would go hungry for a few days, and they would be forced to resupply at the first port they passed, but at least no one would have to stay here and wait for the children to return. He was overseeing the removal of a case of dried fish when his mother walked up to him, holding out a hand.
"Spyglass," she said.
Without a word, he pulled his spyglass out of his coat and handed it to her. She raised the glass to her eye. After a moment, she let out a breath of relief and her arms dropped limply to her sides.
"Light and life, they're early, bless them. Looks like you get your ship back after all."
He took the spyglass from her and took a look at the horizon himself. After a moment of searching, he saw what she already had, a ship approaching from the west. And not just any ship, a ship with blazing red sails sailing with fire in its wake. The Eternal, the ship of Cheska Bennett, guild head of the navigators.
"You really are working closely with her."
He had thought of Alsa's alliance with Cheska as a cooperation between guilds. He hadn't expected the head navigator to be hovering offshore.
"How do you think we got here in the first place?"
Alsa turned to a pair of watchmen who had just added a cask to the growing pile of cargo on the beach.
"Change of plans, gentlemen. Get it all back on the ship."
The two Black Watch members didn't say anything, but Calder sensed sudden despair radiating from them as they eyed the pile of crates and barrels. Urzaiah marched up to Calder, his eye on the horizon as though he could see the Eternal approaching with his naked eyes. He hadn't said a word since his fight with the consultants, and his face was uncharacteristically grim.
"I have failed you again, Captain."
Calder turned to him, surprised.
"Urzaiah, if not for you, I would be dead. Maybe all of us. You have nothing to apologize for."
The big man shook his head, his fists clenched.
"I heard her. They have killed Jirene, and I could not avenge her."
"That's not your responsibility, Urzaiah."
Calder wondered if it was anyone's responsibility. Jerry had kept her own secrets, made her own choices. If those choices had landed her an execution on the Gray Island, that wasn't his fault.
but worry burned in his gut as though he'd swallowed coals.
Captain, I do not mean to argue, but that is not true. I am only strong, and I could not save her. If I can't avenge her, then what can I do?
He heard the despair in the other man's voice, a depth of grief comparable to his own. Urzaiah had spent years with Jerry. He must see the protection of the crew, the whole crew, as his responsibility. How must it hurt to feel like you'd failed everyone under your charge? On second thought, Calder realized he knew exactly what that felt like. Urzaiah took a deep breath, bracing himself.
Good thing I will have another chance.
Calder hated to destroy the man's hopes, but he had to be honest. They have what they wanted. We won't see her again.
I must correct you. I have tasted the blood of the yellow-haired woman.
He drew in another deep breath through his nose, like a bloodhound tasting a scent.
I can follow her as far as she runs.
A moment ago, Calder had been thinking about giving up the chase, but that was when he thought it was impossible. Hope kindled in his chest, and he took a step closer to the soulbound. Are you sure? He'd seen Urzaiah track before, but not across miles of open ocean. That was absurd. Though, if the former champion said he could do it, Calder believed him.
I am sure of nothing, but yes, I can find her.
Suddenly delighted, Calder clapped the man on the back. What can't you do, Urzaiah?
I only have a few gifts, but I use them well.
He gave Calder a wide, gap-toothed smile.
Do not worry, Captain. She cannot hide from me.
Chapter 13. An axe used to split wood for years, for instance, will naturally become invested with a measurable amount of intent. It will excel at splitting wood. Now, if a reader decides to awaken this particular axe, the tool itself will yearn to split wood. It gains a rudimentary consciousness related to its task. Most importantly, it can use its own store of intent to accomplish its goal. An awakened object will no longer gain new intent, but it will become able to use whatever it has already amassed. This is a critical, even disturbing point. Readers often spend months or years studying an object they intend to awaken. If you do not understand an object's intent, you do not understand its goals. If you do not understand its goals, you will not understand its eventual powers. Arthur Belfry, Imperial Witness. Taken from a letter to his pupil, Calder Martin, 14 years of age. 11 years ago. Over the next few months, Calder and Jerry gathered the information they would need to break into Candle Bay Imperial Prison, retrieve Roderick Martin, and leave, preferably without getting caught. They perused textbooks, searched local records for partial blueprints, and sat outside the prison for hours, watching to see if they could catch a glimpse of Roderick in the window. But more than anything else, they plumbed their instructors for information as subtly as they could. On the way to work one day, sitting opposite his mother in their carriage, Calder held up his Black Watch badge to the light.
What sort of authority do we have, as watchmen?
Also looked up in alarm.
You can't arrest anyone. We cannot hold anyone under arrest, except during a guild-sanctioned Black Watch assignment or in certain emergencies.
Calder glanced away from the badge.
Why would you assume that I wanted to arrest someone? It's really not so uncommon as you'd think, she said. Someone always tries it.
He squinted at her, trying to read her expression.
Did you try it?
Spots of color appeared in her cheeks, but her smile was fond.
On your father.
Calder promised himself that he would get the full story from her another time.
I don't want to arrest anyone. Not at the moment. I'm just wondering what we can do.
She sighed.
You must remember that the Black Watch are never held in the highest public opinion, so the people will resist you, fear you, and work against you if they get the chance.
Calder had already begun to notice that. He tried to refrain from wearing his badge and black coat until he actually arrived on the Testament's worksite to avoid the frightened looks and dark comments.
Technically, you can order any citizen to do anything if it relates to an elder or elder magic, or if elderspawn have been spotted in the area. Anything legal, she amended. You can call on Imperial troops or other low-ranking guild members to assist you in your duties, and they are bound by the Emperor's decree to comply to the best of their ability.
That sounded promising. He could simply order the staff of Candle Bay to release his father, claiming that he was suspected of elder corruption. If they argued, he could threaten them with the involvement of Imperial troops. They would likely give him whatever he wanted. The future was looking bright until she added,
Of course, you have to justify whatever you do to the guild head.
Picturing Bliss's blank expression, Calder froze.
If you have her authorization to begin with, there's no problem. But if you're operating on your own and she doesn't approve, you'll have to answer to her.
Ulsa leaned forward in the carriage, placing her hand on his knee, and looked into Calder's eyes with absolute gravity.
Calder, you don't want to answer to Bliss.
No, I do not, he agreed. He would have to come up with a different plan. She leaned back, satisfied.
Then she added, And don't arrest anyone. Did you know my mother once worked in an Imperial prison?
Jirene mentioned idly during a tutoring session. Arthur's eyebrows raised.
Oh, is that so? Well, the Journal of Estes Six only mentions prisons this once. If you'll return your attention to the text, you'll see.
Did Esther help to establish the original prisons?
She interrupted.
As I said, her journal only mentions them once, in passing.
Calder decided to throw in his support.
But surely you know if there's a connection, right? She's one of the heroes of the early Empire. She has to be mentioned in more than just her own journal.
Arthur glanced over at Voris, who was scribbling something on a loose piece of paper.
This is really my brother's area of expertise, more than mine.
Voris held up a sheet of paper. Jorin designed, it read. Esther enforced. Arthur brightened.
Ah, of course. Thank you, Voris. You see, the original Imperial prison was built off the coast of Aurelia, on the land we now know as the Grey Island. It was a prototype designed and built by Jorin himself. Jorin Cursebreaker. Jorin Mazewalker. He gets less of a mention in history because he tended not to involve himself openly in battles, but many historians speculate that he was one of the Emperor's original companions.
Finally, an interesting story out of Imperial history.
Does that have any relationship to Imperial prisons today?
Jerry asked, as Calder feverishly sketched notes.
Very little, I would think. Jorin's prototype is more the sort of thing you'd find in an adventure novel. Spikes, false passages, alchemical traps, stone invested to trap intruders. I suspect it was more of a hobby to him than a serious architectural endeavor.
Calder dropped his pen, disappointed, but Voris had picked his back up. He held out another sheet of paper to his brother.
That's right,
Arthur exclaimed, skimming the note.
One of the most innovative bits of reading in Imperial history, and I almost forgot to mention it. Jorin designed one mechanism for the gates of his Grey Island labyrinth that is supposedly still in use today. Modern prisons all have some analog of this device, you see.
Calder tried to keep the impatience from his voice.
And? What is it?
In excitement, Arthur pounded his massive fist on the table. Everything on the wooden surface jumped 6 inches in the air.
A way to detect readers. Imagine it. There's no difference medically in readers and ordinary people, so there should be nothing to detect, but Jorin managed to pull it off nonetheless. I suppose he uses a structure that is particularly sensitive to unconscious intent, but I can't imagine how.
What good does that do?
Jirene asked.
Surely they know if their prisoners are readers or not.
Not the prisoners. Well, yes, the prisoners too, but the staff and the visitors and everyone who passes through a particular doorway. You can imagine the problems back then, of course. Any reader who was taken prisoner could spend weeks investing a tool, even something so simple as a stick, then shatter the lock with a touch and stroll out. And a reader who wanted to break someone else out would have only to disguise themselves as staff and have the run of the facility. This device prevents that, both in ancient prisons and today. A remarkable bit of intent manipulation.
Calder's hopes fell, dashed against reality like those escaping prisoners against the rocks of Candle Bay. If they could tell he was a reader, they'd be watching him from the second he walked in the door. Arthur continued, not noticing his student's mood.
That brings us right around to Estes 6. At the time, she was functioning as an interim head of the Imperial Guard, so she made sure that the trap-detecting readers was keyed to a device in her possession. If she was alerted to a reader trying to sneak out of, or into, an Imperial prison, she would send a squad of Imperial Guards to investigate. To this day, any prison in the capital can requisition Imperial Guards to respond in case of an emergency.
Calder almost groaned out loud. By contrast, Jirene looked delighted. She glanced at him and surreptitiously pointed to herself. When Calder figured out what she meant, he shook his head. She pointed to herself more firmly this time. He shook his head harder. 2 hours later, Jirene confronted him in the hall outside his room.
It has to be me, she said, arms crossed. We don't know where this detector is. It could be in the front door, or it could be in the warden's quarters. Besides, I'll be able to sense it before I run into it. If a reader could sense it, what use would it be?
She made a good point.
We just don't know enough, he said finally. There's a lot more we need to learn. It would be best if we could visit the prison and get a look for ourselves, but they've turned me away every time. If we snuck in at night, if I snuck in, she corrected, because you'd get caught by their magical sensor.
It burned, but she was right. He'd have to rely on her to sneak in. Not that he had to tell her yet.
We'll see, he said at last. I'll see plenty, because I'll be in the prison while you're outside waiting.
She uncrossed her arms, smiling proudly. Calder grumbled and started to make his way downstairs. He was halfway down the staircase when his mother called his name. She came around the corner carrying an envelope, resting on a tray and sealed with orange wax.
Post for you, she said.
By working alongside her on the docks, he had gotten to know her better, and he'd say she sounded surprised. Jirene took the letter from the tray, glanced at it, and gasped. Calder held out a hand, and she gave it over wordlessly. Delivered to Mr. Calder Martin and his current guardian at the residence of Ms. Alsa Greyweather. Sender, Candle Bay Imperial Prison and Reformative Facility. He tore the envelope open with shaking hands. The letter was a single sheet of paper with remarkably brief contents. Mr. Martin, we are delighted to inform you that our resident, Mr. Roderick Martin, has recovered from his most recent medical procedure and is delighted to receive you. Please present yourself at the Candle Bay facility on the second day of next week, between the hours of 3 and 4 in the afternoon. Cordially and professionally, Ulrich Fletcher, Warden of Candle Bay. Chapter 14. Present Day. Every time Calder saw Cheska Bennett, her hat got bigger. This time it was a dark blue, two-cornered hat, 2 feet tall and wide enough to serve her as a lifeboat. She wore a jacket and pants to match, both blue and trimmed in gold. Everything was trimmed in gold, in fact. Her boots, the buttons